It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Melissa Block is a very familiar name and voice to public radio audiences, whether it's from her New York-based reporting, her dozen years as co-host of All Things Considered, or in her current role as special correspondent for NPR. Melissa Block is coming to Pittsburgh Tuesday to participate in the Media Innovator Speaker Series at Point Park University's Pittsburgh Playhouse. Melissa, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Melissa, is this your first trip to Pittsburgh?
It is my first trip to Pittsburgh, which just seems so wrong, and I'm so glad that I'm getting a chance to fix it.
Hold it. You've been all over the country, around the world.
I know. It's horrifying, and I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I'll be coming to your city with fresh eyes and ears, and really looking forward to being there.
We're glad you can check that off your list finally.
Absolutely.
Listeners hear you identified as special correspondent. That's not a role that NPR hands out often. I believe Susan Stamberg might have been the first one to get that title. Is that right?
Yeah. And I guess when I'm on the air, I don't self-identify that way. I mean, it's a title. You know, what does it mean? Am I very special? I don't think I'm particularly special. I just have the freedom to travel around and to come up with stories that don't necessarily fit into a particular beat. Mostly domestic travel, some international, but I just am able to craft my interests in ways that that interest me, which is a wonderful freedom to have.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. And just that all your different experiences come into play in that, whether it was an editorial assistant, a producer on All Things Considered, of course, your longtime reporting and your hosting, blending all those skill sets together to identify those stories.
Right. And I guess what is underpinning all of it for me and always has been is finding characters and profiling people who are intimately involved in something they're doing. And it doesn't necessarily have to be anybody famous, but I have spent the last two Olympic cycles doing profiles of Olympic athletes, which has been really fascinating. And anybody who is that devoted to their sport, and sometimes sports that really have no recognition. I mean, badminton and biathlon in this country are not exactly marquee sports. But also, you know, digging into more topical issues like immigration, healthcare. I did a long series of stories a couple years ago called Our Land, where I traveled around with my producer, Alyssa Nadworny, and profiled different communities and how our identity is shaped by where we live. So it might mean you are a salmon fisherman in Sitka, Alaska, and what does that mean to you, and how does a changing climate affect what you do? Or you are an Uzbek family becoming U.S. citizens on the day of their naturalization ceremony. I followed them through that day, and just sort of getting windows into different people's worlds and bringing them to our audience.
I noticed that you mentioned finding characters before you said stories. Was that intentional?
Well, I guess it's always been how I approach stories, is through a pretty, I prefer a pretty narrow frame. I think there are some reporters who are excellent at doing sort of long, wide frame explanatory journalism. Here's a big topic, and I'm going to have a lot of different people talking to you about it. And I much prefer to go narrow and deeper with one person. It's I think, what I do best. Not that there's anything wrong with the other approach, but it just is always how I prefer to do my reporting, is really to spend as much time as possible with a character. Maybe it's a family, a small group of people, but to really try to get to know them as deeply as they're willing to let me get to know them.
You spent 12 years as a co-host of All Things Considered, but you weren't exactly tied to the co-host chair. You weren't limited to doing interviews with guests and debriefing reporters. How important to you as a journalist was that flexibility to still get out there and report?
Oh, it's vital. And I think, you know, it was certainly not limited to me. All the current hosts of All Things Considered and Morning Edition do the same thing. I mean, to be in the studio, as valid as that is, and I'm sure you love what you do, and to be, you know, interviewing people in place is great, but you get such a different perspective by going out to where people are. You know, it struck me at one point, like, I've never been to the Mexico border, U.S.-Mexico border. I should really fix that. It takes you outside of yourself, and just certainly getting outside of Washington, where, look, people here can really have tunnel vision and not really digest what is going on around the country, what issues are important to them, how the things that are being talked about in Washington affect people's daily lives in other parts of the country, and just different perspectives, different focus of what is important where people live. And that it's so important to get out, not just around the country, actually, but around the world. And, you know, that informs everything that they do once they get back in the studio, because they have that knowledge base.
So what has hosting done for your individual skills, having to sort of stay on top of several stories a day rather than focus on that one story, that one topic you're reporting on that day over the course of a few days?
Right. I guess, you know, it makes you a quicker study, for sure. For better or for worse, you need to be able to digest things quickly and not know everything about a subject, obviously, but to be able to know what questions to ask, right? What questions other people might be curious about and thinking about. And it does mean just compartmentalizing your brain in certain ways, because you may be, as host, going from a story, you know, say the recent airplane crash, you might need to be focusing on that and then going to something totally different. It could be a feature interview with a musician or an author or an actor. So you need to be able to shift gears. You need to be able to read quickly, write quickly. It can be pretty relentless.
Not everyone gets the chance to reinvent themselves in that way, switching roles over the course of a career. How do you think it's affected your personal trajectory?
Oh, gosh. I guess maybe I'm helped by the fact that I never had a five-year plan, Kevin. I mean, maybe if I did, I would have been a little more linear. But, you know, I just loved learning different things to do here. And so I loved, as a producer, I loved mixing pieces. I loved going out in the field. I loved gathering tape and thinking about putting that puzzle together in the most creative and listener-friendly way. And that certainly informed the reporter I was. I always think that as a reporter, I think like a producer. I think about sound and I think about moving a story along with sound, because we have this incredible medium, this amazingly powerful and intimate medium of radio and the power of the human voice. So I think certainly that informed my reporting. My reporting informed my hosting. And I suppose now the hosting informs my reporting, now that I'm back sort of traveling around and doing that again.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our special guest is NPR host, special correspondent Melissa Block, who's coming to Pittsburgh Tuesday to participate in the Media Innovator Speaker Series at Point Park University. Melissa, we were talking about the evolution of your role, but so too has NPR evolved. Where do you want the network and your place in it to go from here?
Boy, it's changed so much. I mean, I started in 1985, so it's been 34 years, which is pretty crazy. And when I think back on those early days and compare them to where we are now, I mean, NPR is much, much bigger and has a much larger reach than we did back then. We have reporters in places that we would not have dreamed of ever having staff before. I mean, when I started, we had one foreign correspondent, and now we have dozens all over the globe. And it certainly has changed most recently in how we deliver the things that we create. So when I started, it was purely radio. There was no web. There was no internet. And if you look back at our very earliest forays into, you know, doing web build-outs for the radio stories we do, it looks primitive. It looks like it was a different century. But and now with the boom in podcasts, I think there's a whole new generation of people coming up who are doing experimental storytelling and really digging deep into things and keeping listeners' attention in ways that we always knew could be done, but that maybe we've drifted away from on the terrestrial radio side as pieces get shorter and attention spans, we assume, are smaller. But I think podcasting has taught us that people do care about depth and long-form journalism. And I think that's really, really heartening and exciting, and certainly lessons from that should be applied to what we do on the radio as well.
You've reported on more than your share of tragedies, whether they're man-made or natural disasters, from 9/11 as a New York-based reporter to Katrina to the devastating earthquake in Sichuan, China. How did they affect you personally, either during your reporting time there or maybe when you got back home?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think this is a pretty common response that when you are covering a story, you in a sense have to put blinders on, emotional blinders on to do the job. But as a reporter, you have a mission and you can bring that story to other people, which can feel like a gift at the time. I mean, the trouble is that the trauma hits later, right? And you may be not fully digesting what it is that you've seen or what you've heard from people. Not that I was directly affected by it. I didn't lose people. I didn't know anyone who died on 9/11. But you're surrounded by people who did, and that does take a toll. In that case, and also with the China earthquake, I mean, all things considered, had gone to China, I should explain, before the Beijing Olympics in 2008. And we wanted to go to a part of China that wasn't paid attention to as much. And we just happened to be in Chengdu in Sichuan province when the earthquake hit. And one of the main tragedies that arose from that story, of all the thousands of people, tens of thousands of people killed, it was estimated 90,000 total, a lot of them were children, because schools, the earthquake happened in the middle of the day, and children were in school, and a lot of the schools had horribly shoddy construction, as it turned out. They call it tofu dregs construction. In other words, not even tofu, but the stuff that's left after you make the tofu, which is such an image that I just can't shake. At any rate, part of what I witnessed was, you know, the bodies of very young children being pulled out of a school that had been destroyed. I had, at the time, a young daughter, and it was impossible for me not to sort of make that equation in my own mind. But again, that didn't hit me until weeks later, sort of the effect of that.
One of your reports I remember most was about a couple searching for their missing son. Does that individual story sort of help us better comprehend maybe the incomprehensibility of the total devastation?
Right. And I think this gets back to what I was saying earlier about how I tend to narrow the frame and zoom in closely. When we went out to do a story, I think it was the 2 days, 3 days after the earthquake in one of the cities that had been hardest hit, I had assumed we would sort of drive around the city and talk to a lot of people and visit as many sites as we could. And when we happened to find this couple who were literally, we found them, we were driving down one of the main roads, and they were literally, it looked like they were trying to pull an excavator with their bare hands toward their apartment building. They were so desperate to have heavy equipment come in and try to go through the rubble to see whether their toddler son and his grandparents had survived. So they finally had found an excavator. They were dragging it with them, and we followed them. And it became so clear to me that we were going to stay with them for the entire day until they found out what happened, one way or the other, that there was no point in my leaving and going to find another voice and another voice after that, that their story would be the story that we would tell. And I do think it reaches people in a different way when you spend that amount of time and you get invested in them and you want to know what happens. That story had a really big impact, and I was really gratified by that and extremely grateful to that couple who did not have to let us stay with them all day, and they did, and they saw the value in it somehow, even in the midst of their tragedy and their grief. They saw the value in having their story be told.
You said stories that reach people. You mentioned the Our Land series a couple of years ago. You reached out to people. You were traveling the country. What did you learn about the country and our people?
Well, I guess one of the takeaways for me is that as much as we talk about division and divisiveness, and there certainly is that, and I don't mean to downplay it, that there are also really powerful threads that bind us together. And I don't mean to sound like a Pollyanna. I understand that there are real complicated issues and problems in this country. But I think if we ignore the other parts that link us, then we lose something. And I was really delighted to be able to get around the country and explore some of those issues. And again, it may not be just things that make us happy about ourselves, but it may be the notion that even in a conservative town in a conservative state, if you lose your hospital, and you might start thinking about healthcare in a different way and about Medicaid expansion, and that those issues cross party lines in ways that are not easily put into boxes. And I think the inclination sometimes is to divide people up into, you know, where do you fall? And a lot of people, it's more complicated than that. And that's part of what I enjoy in my reporting, is trying to illuminate those spaces that aren't easily defined or put into boxes.
When you do speaking engagements, such as the one you're going to be doing here in Pittsburgh on Tuesday, what do you want to learn? What do you want to take away?
A lot of what I'm interested in, well, A, learning about a new place. So I'm really interested in learning about Pittsburgh. And I'm going to turn to you, Kevin, to let me know like what I should absolutely see before I leave. And I know there's a lot. But also just getting a sense of what is on people's minds in different places, and what the most interesting or controversial issues are in that particular place. You can get a pretty strong flavor of a town or of a city in not too long a time. Chances are I'm going to want to spend more time than I have. But also in talking to students and hearing how they think, and maybe how they approach journalism in a very different way than I'm used to coming to it as early as I did. That's always really illuminating and exciting for me, too, to hear from young people.
Longtime NPR host, reporter, and now special correspondent Melissa Block is the guest of the Media Innovator Speaker Series at Point Park University's Pittsburgh Playhouse Tuesday evening. Melissa, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Oh, you bet.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Pittsburgh native Bria Thomas has been mixing music for the city's nightlife for nearly a decade. She goes by the stage name DJ Femi and is heading to Austin, Texas this week for a chance to perform at the Music and Media Festival South by Southwest. And it's been 12 years since officials from the city gave the Penguins redevelopment rights to the old Civic Arena site. Now, after plans, revised plans, renegotiations, and some missed deadlines, development could begin this fall. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Joan Armatrading. Born in the West Indies and raised in the UK, Joan Armatrading creates music that transcends culture and genre, seamlessly blending rock, jazz, folk, reggae, and blues, anchored by her distinctive alto vocals. Armatrading's first album appeared in 1972, but it wasn't until 1976 that she scored her first top 10 hit, Love and Affection.
We'll give you love.
Just make love with affection.
In 1980, Me, Myself, I became her highest charting album, marking a move away from her folk origins to rock and pop. Armatrading became the first female British blues artist to top the U.S. Billboard blues charts with the 2007 album Into the Blues. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
A report finds coal ash pollution is leaking into groundwater at power plants all across the country. 9 are in Pennsylvania. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holzapfel. Coal ash is the waste from combustion at coal-fired power plants. The report from the Environmental Integrity Project and Earth Justice found over 90% of sites that store coal ash are leaking levels of contamination exceeding EPA health standards. Here with more is the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier. Hi, Reed.
Hello, Kara.
When we say that coal ash waste is leaking, where is it being stored and how is it getting out?
There's two main ways that utilities have traditionally stored coal ash. One is mix it with water and put it into these artificial ponds. The other is in landfills. Recent rules passed by the federal government require utilities to store coal ash in a landfill or an ash pond that is lined. But the vast majority of plants have these unlined landfills and ash ponds from decades ago, and that's where the vast majority of coal ash goes today. Here's the study's lead author, Abel Russ. He's an attorney with the Environmental Integrity Project.
They dumped it in unlined pits, frequently in contact with groundwater, and they just kept filling them up for decades, and this is the end result.
So the report was examining data from 265 coal plants or offsite disposal areas, and that included over 550 impoundments and landfills nationwide.
So what's the public health concern over coal ash waste in groundwater? Is it as bad as it sounds?
Coal contains a lot of naturally occurring metals and elements, but when they're concentrated the way they would be in ash after you burn all this stuff, it's hazardous to your health. At one former coal plant near Pittsburgh up in Newcastle, arsenic levels in the groundwater are 372 times what the EPA says is safe for drinking water. Though groundwater near these sites isn't necessarily used for drinking water, the contaminants could migrate to underground drinking wells, into rivers and streams, and eventually to public drinking water systems. Arsenic is a neurotoxin. It can impair development in children and lower their IQ, and it also has been linked to several types of cancers.
What are the federal EPA and the state Department of Environmental Protection doing about coal ash pollution?
Well, I asked for a response from both agencies, and they both say they're reviewing the reports. The EPA stresses that the monitoring data used in the report is only sort of one part of the process. If these facilities are found to be threatening drinking water supplies, they will have to be closed and cleaned up. The DEP says it has stricter rules than the EPA's when it comes to coal ash, which isn't surprising. We're a big coal state. And they say that when pollution is noticed in groundwater monitors at sites in Pennsylvania, there's an evaluation and assessment process that's triggered, and this can also include cleaning up a site. And another thing that the DEP likes to stress is that public drinking water supplies have to test for a lot of the pollutants found in coal ash, including arsenic. I should say that last year, the Trump administration rolled back parts of that 2015 coal ash rule, making it easier for companies to get waivers for some of those groundwater monitoring requirements and delay closing some unlined facilities or those built too close to underground aquifers, which is another aspect of the 2015 rule.
Thanks, Reed.
Thank you.
Reed Fraser covers energy for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania. There's a link to the report at alleghenyfront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Kara Holsapel.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh native Bria Thomas, who goes by the stage name DJ Femi, has been mixing music for the city's nightlife for nearly a decade. After attending Pittsburgh Creative and Performing Arts High School for cello and piano, she started performing around the city. Now she has regular engagements at restaurants and clubs and is headed to the Music and Media Festival South by Southwest to perform for entertainers across the country. 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley sat down with DJ Femi ahead of her trip to Austin.
I've been DJing for about 9 years now. That's what I do. I play music. I get the party started. I'm a nightlife curator. It's an amazing feeling, you know, being able to do what you love to do. What kind of sets me apart as a DJ here in Pittsburgh, I'm really good at maintaining the party and keeping a crowd and making sure, you know, the crowd never stops dancing.
Was it difficult to break into the nightlife scene in Pittsburgh?
It was hard just being a woman at first and just, you know, constantly getting told no, or, you know, we're not going to go with you because we have another DJ and it's a guy. So that was kind of hard at first, but I kind of had to gain some momentum and fans and a lot more support than I had when I first started. And then people started taking me serious. I think it just made me want to keep going. Honestly, it kind of like put a drive in me. All the no's that I got, all the doors that were closed, just because of I'm a girl, you know, that kind of sucked. But it definitely made me mentally want to keep going and just like prove everybody wrong and, you know, prove it to myself that I know I can do it, you know.
You have regular gigs at Scenario on the South Side, Umami in Lawrenceville, and you perform at gallery crawls downtown in places like Boom Concepts and Garfield. They're all so different. Do you like that? Do you feel like you can be authentic?
I love it because I do listen to all different types of music. So that part is not hard for me to, you know, have fun playing different genres of music. And I've kind of been tapping into a lot of other genres that I normally wouldn't get booked for anyway. So it's really fun to be, you know, playing on the South Side when I'm playing EDM music, and then I'm going to Lawrenceville and I'm playing, you know, reggae, and then, you know, so it's really fun.
Ooh, ooh. See, can't get too much of a good thing. Mm-hmm. What is the DJ scene like in Pittsburgh?
As far as DJs in particular, I think that we could do a lot of work, you know, just in terms of support and stuff like that and supporting each other. But I think that the community right now of DJs is just so small. At least, like, it's very separated right now by genre and by area. I think that we can do better at that and accepting other DJs, you know, into new different parts of Pittsburgh. But I think the music culture in Pittsburgh is well on its way.
After you return from South by Southwest, what are you looking forward to?
In the next year, I would love to be on tour. That's my goal. I would love to have my own tour one day. And other than that, just, you know, working on getting out there, meeting new people, networking and all that. So I just look forward to the journey that is going to happen for sure after South by Southwest.
Bria Thomas performs around Pittsburgh as DJ Femi and is headed to the South by Southwest Music Festival. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Get ready for work, work, work.
That was 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley talking with Pittsburgh's DJ Femi. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The old Civic Arena, closed nearly 9 years ago, was demolished 7 years ago, and the 28-acre site has sat undeveloped for all of these years. Now the redevelopment might begin again this fall. So what's going to happen? What's the timeline? Well, just a couple of the questions we're going to put to Bob Bowder, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome back to the program, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
And Margaret J. Krause, WESA reporter covering development and transportation. Margaret, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
All right. It's been a decade or more of negotiations, announced plans, delays, missed deadlines. Do you have a sense of just how much confidence there is among, we'll start with officials and then also within the community, that work will actually begin in 6 months or so? Bob, let's start with you.
Well, I think the opinion of public officials is that it will finally begin, but I'm not so sure that the neighborhood believes that, mm-hmm. from what I'm hearing from them.
Okay. Margaret, confidence scale, 1 to 10, officials and community. What are you hearing?
Officials are very certain, instead of saying things like, we believe they're working in good faith. Now it's, this is going to happen, there are going to be shovels in the ground. And my understanding is community members are waiting to see because they've heard a lot of, it's next year, it's the one after that, it's the one after that. So I think they're just waiting.
All right. So you agree it might be a little lower or wait and see?
Yeah, that's the shorter answer.
Okay. So when this announcement was made several days ago, were officials asked about possible skepticism? We'll wait to the first shovel in the ground? Or it really wasn't a news briefing, was it? It was a release, wasn't it?
Yes, they released it through an email that they, you know, were going to finally begin construction. And they also announced a new development team for the project.
All right. Just a regrouping or just brand new to the project, Bob?
Well, it's brand new people. They brought in an architectural firm and a development company, and they want to move ahead now with this.
Do we know why they decided to change teams?
Not all of the, as Bob said, it was an email release, so we didn't have the opportunity yet to ask direct questions to the Penguins and their development arm. In fact, I was told that they were, you know, the release was, it was so detailed that they were just going to wait to make further comment. So I don't know exactly why. The former housing lead was McCormick Barron Salazar, which is known for its affordable housing work. But their plan rested on receiving low-income housing tax credits, which go from the federal government to the state government. Those tax credits were not awarded. And so there was this financing gap of about $3 million between what they thought they could do and what they were getting financed. So that's the last I heard in terms of these machinations that were going on. And on Friday, they announced it's a new housing developer lead, as well as an overall lead Bikini pollen.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, was it like the developer, you said housing, sort of pulled out, or
I don't really know.
But they didn't get what they thought they could get, the tax credit, is
right.
What
and that changed plans significantly.
Right. Let's back up a little bit, if we might. I mentioned all those years, a decade of negotiations. The deal to keep the Penguins from moving to Kansas City was signed, I think, 12 years ago. Is that
2007.
Right? Okay. During the Ravenstahl administration, it included a new arena and the development rights to the parcel of land that included the old arena site. So what did the Penguins agree to do? What did they promise to do?
Was basically to keep the team in town. That was a deal with the governor, Ed Rendell, at the time, to keep the Penguins in the city of Pittsburgh.
Right. I remember covering that news conference. Rendell holds a news conference, I believe it's outside the state office building, because he was flying around with the Penguins trying to convince them not to go to Kansas City. So what about agreement, promises regarding the development aspect? Or was this, okay, as long as you stay, it's okay?
I think, thankfully, we've moved into a slightly different era of development. The promises that were incumbent on the Penguins were not particularly oriented toward community benefit. The idea was this large, broad benefit of the Penguins stay in town with all of their ability to bring people in for games and revenue. They had to develop. The original options agreement didn't really provide any incentives to encourage that development. There were no penalties, really. They were given money to buy the parcels from the SEA, the Sports and Exhibition Authority, and the URA, which own the land. These public authorities own the land.
Where was that money coming from? They were given money to buy the land from, I mean.
This is coming from the gambling tax revenue pot that the Hill District gets every year.
All right. So it was revenues generated, in a sense, public revenues to buy publicly owned land?
Not a great deal.
All right.
And in fact, Kevin Ackland, formerly the chief of staff for Mayor Bill Peduto, then lead solicitor for People's Gas, and now he's with the Penguins as their chief solicitor. He told me a couple of years ago, one of our main priorities when we came into office was to renegotiate the options agreement with the Penguins because it was not oriented toward community benefit.
Was it the – go ahead, Bob. I'm sorry.
And they did the URA over time institute penalties against the Penguins that they gave them deadlines. You have this long to begin development or you are going to lose parking tax revenue on the property that they receive from folks who park on that property in the parking lots on the old arena site.
And getting to that renegotiation took a long time. The Penguins blew through deadlines. Mm-hmm. And depending on who you talked with, they were like, you know, these are reasonable delays. We want to encourage development. We're not going to bring down the hammer on them. Councilman Lavelle, who represents the Hill, Councilman Daniel Lavelle, said, you know, I think that we should try and get the rights back to this land at one point because there had been this long malaise of no development. So that renegotiation of the options agreement took until the end of 2017. And it said, if you don't develop 6.45 acres by 2020, you lose 20% of the revenue.
6.45 acres, what is that, like a quarter of the
property? The whole property is 28 acres.
Okay. So the point being is, they had deadlines prior to that in the earlier options agreement. Bob, you mentioned penalties, but they were never really penalized?
Well, they were given extensions, and there were extenuating circumstances. For instance,
for sure,
they lost the U.S. Steel building that was there was an agreement for U.S. Steel to build an office building on that property, and then the economy, they pulled out of that deal. So there were circumstances that, in fairness to the Penguins, prevented them from moving ahead with development.
And I think that's a really great point, because private capital is not that patient, and pulling together a deal this big has got to be incredibly difficult. So I think when officials said, you know, they are acting in good faith, you know, I think they, in many times, they were. So, but they just were, they had an agreement that was very favorable toward
the Penguins.
Toward the Penguins. Right. And, you know, they, to their credit, have been working on it and working away and have changed teams, and now they say they're going to develop.
And they have been getting revenues on that now parking lot where the arena stood. And so they haven't exactly been losing money.
No.
Okay. So you each have mentioned an important word in all this that cannot be forgotten, and that is community. Margaret, you spoke with Marimba Malines, the leader of the Hill Community Development Corporation. Let's listen to what she told you.
Everyone in the region is ready to see this development happen. And of course, the Hill District community and hopefully all of our elected officials, it depends, are equally eager to make sure that our goals are met.
Well, I can tell you that the Penguins have received flack from various Hill District community organizations over the years. They've been unhappy about the deal that was struck originally. They've been unhappy about the lack of movement on the property, and they have voiced those opinions publicly many times over the years.
Yeah, and Councilman Daniel Lavelle represents the Hill District. Margaret, he's been angry. He's been a critic for years about the delays. What did he tell you?
He said it can't be overstated that the Greater Hill District Investment Fund, the whole engine of redevelopment in the middle and upper hill depends on the lower hill development. There's a tax abatement that's going to allow 50% of the revenue to be invested in this Greater Hill District Investment Fund to hopefully continue to bring, you know, housing stabilization, workforce development, business development, all those sorts of important things to the hill. And his main critique is they have this land. Beginning development is the mechanism to allow that investment to happen, and it's just sitting there. Why? Why can we not do something?
All right. So what details do we know of phase one that is supposed to start in the fall?
Well, they say they're going to start with the residential development first by fall of this year. And by winter of this year, they start on office entertainment development.
Mm-hmm. Affordable housing, Margaret. Is there a consensus of what is meant by affordable, though?
These units in this first phase, the first phase of housing to start this fall is 250 units. And it has a portion of affordable housing, but that would be open to people who make 80% of the area median income, which would be for a family about 80%.
Go ahead.
It's about $76,000. And so the city acknowledges in its own documents that the greatest housing need in Pittsburgh is for people who make 30% or less of the area median income. And so I have not yet heard from specific advocates in terms of what they think of this new deal, but there have been complaints in the past that the level of affordability that's planned does not meet the actual need in Pittsburgh or the Hill in particular.
We have just about 30 seconds left. So are there still steps that need to be accomplished before shovel and ground?
Not that I'm aware of. I think they can just begin. They have all the SEA has put in all the infrastructure on the property, so it's ready to go.
And Margaret, any procedural steps?
There are some procedural steps. The plan still has to go before the Hill District's Development Review Panel, which is an 11-member body comprised of different groups in the Hill, and then the Planning Commission, Pittsburgh's Planning Commission. They need a final land development plan, which has not yet been approved.
All right. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's reporter covering development and transportation. Bob Bowder is reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. And thank you so much to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
For today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow at this time, the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue nearly 5 months ago stirred up a lot of questions about community and the politics of aid. In the aftermath, the spotlight has been placed on religious and political divisions within the Jewish community and its effort to heal after the October attack. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovic, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Till next time, hope you have a good day of good news.